He bought me lunch on Friday. I'm completely distrustful of it all.
Yeah, and I was told never to use that analogy again.
Added extra antioxidants. Stop, that's twice today. You care, now you feel bad.
Are you buying it yet? The FNETF stands for fun.
Hi, I'm Maria Bruno, head of U.S. Wealth Planning Research here at Vanguard.
And I'm Joel Dixon, global head of advice methodology at Vanguard. Welcome to our podcast series, The Planner and the Geek, in which we will discuss topics that are important to individual investors.
And we'll have some fun along the way.
So I spent the weekend car shopping.
You did?
I did.
You already have a car. Actually, we have two cars, Joel.
Oh, yeah. Let's not get into car number two. But, yeah, no, I have one car that's on lease, which the whole issue from a financial planning standpoint, why I leased rather than bought, is a subject for a different podcast. But, yeah, so the lease is running up soon, so I gotta find a replacement.
Well, you could also keep the car you have. That's one option. You could
buy
it.
Yeah, I could. That's not why I made the lease choice, if you will. It's because I actually like the new technology every couple of years. That's what I kind of look for in a car. That's what's important to me is, you know, kind of having that up to date.
So did you actually start looking, or are you starting to think through it?
Actually, kind of both.
Mm-hmm.
It takes me a while to process these things, so.
So you're going to buy the same car you have now, but in a newer model. Is that what you're going to do? Maybe in a different color?
No, it would be the same color.
Instead of silver, you'll buy dark gray?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you're probably not that far off, quite honestly. But I have to see what the features are in the new model. So.
Not me. I'm fine with my old car.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Does your technology sync up with it?
It syncs well enough.
Syncs well enough. What does that mean?
It syncs well enough. It's fine. Gets me where I need to go. It's a good ride. Solid car. Knock wood.
Yeah. Actually, it's funny.
Oh, no. I was just going to say, a friend of mine used this analogy that there's four phases of car ownership. One is like, oh, I have this new car. Smells great. Looks great. Oh, no. I got my first ding or my first accident. Then two, oh, I have this car. It's great. It's trustworthy. Don't really care too much about it. And then the fourth phase is, oh, I need a new car. I'm kind of in that third phase right now.
That sounds like those four phases could apply to many different things in life.
Yeah, we were talking about it in the conversation.
Relationships, you know, life generally.
Different podcasts, Joel, different podcasts.
Ah, yeah, this is true. We did just do one on retirement happiness. So. No, it's interesting. Years ago, I had a rental car when my car had gotten a ding, got its first ding, and it was getting fixed, and I had a rental car, and I was just like, oh, just give me the cheapest thing possible. And at the time, my kids were really quite young, probably about 7 and 5 or something like that. And I ended up getting this really kind of subcompact, no kind of additional accessories on it car, which was great. They thought it was the greatest car I ever had because it had the roll down windows, manual windows in the back seat, so dad couldn't control whether or not they were playing with the windows. It was like the best thing, and my kids are both going, dad, can we get a car like this? We really want a car like this. And meanwhile, you know, random times they're just rolling stuff down, rolling it up. Anyway, it's the simple things in life that are the most pleasurable, right?
Yeah. After a few trips in that car, they probably wouldn't be happy with it.
Oh, I don't know. They loved that car.
Their arms would be tired from opening and closing those windows.
That's right. Exactly. So, yeah, the discussion we wanted to have today, I think, is a lot like this, the car discussion that you and I just had, which is how much is kind of the new technology or the new approach versus the, you know, hey, you know, what I have is good enough. It works plenty well. You know, and in the investment space these days, that discussion comes up all the time in this thing, you know, called ETFs or exchange traded funds. And you know, are they better than, different from, not as good as traditional mutual funds that so many people.
Or really all of the above, right?
Right, exactly. And oftentimes it does get down a lot as well. Talk about, I'm sure, individual preferences.
Preferences, yeah.
You know, what's good enough? What feature do I need? What feature don't I need, right?
Well, we were talking earlier about phones. You asked me what version of phones I have. It's the same thing. I think we pick our phones based upon what features we like. For iPhone users, for instance, of which I am one, the convenience. It's very easy to use.
Oh, yeah, and all the stuff that's integrated. And it, actually, I was having that discussion with my daughter over the weekend, and I said I'd been looking at our phone bill, and it was interesting to see how we, there are three of us on the phone plan that I have, and the three of us each use our phones very differently. But so my daughter probably uses about 75% of the total data that we use among the three of us, whereas I do about 75 or 80% of the text messages among the three of us. And then my daughter, who used to be heavy in text messages, now never uses it. And I'm just like, and you know, it's because she's gone to things like Snapchat that uses data.
Nobody talks? What about voice?
Nobody talks. Voice, almost no one talks. Very, very little, you know, in terms of that. Yeah, I mean, we maybe use, oh, I don't know, under an hour a month.
That's
of minutes.
Telling. Interesting.
Isn't it? Between text and data, that's how all of the conversations occur now. It is interesting just to see the same use, the same vehicle, if you will, but for different uses, mm-hmm. you know, and how, you know, those approaches can meet different needs.
Well, we talk about this in the context, like today we're talking about ETFs, for instance, but you could use the same argument, and we've made this argument as well, when you think about account types. There are some accounts that are multitasking type accounts. There are retirement vehicles, but there may be some liquidity features. So yes, I think you can port this conversation to investing as well.
Right, like not using a health savings account just for medical purposes or delaying it for many years.
That's another podcast, Joel.
Roth IRAs as an emergency spending account?
I think we did that one.
Oh, dang it. So many other podcasts that we're covering today.
All right, let's talk about ETFs. So exchange-traded funds.
The F in ETF does stand for fund.
First time you used that in a webcast, I thought they were going to bleep you.
I know. That would be awful.
So let's talk about that. What exactly are they?
We need to break it down, but I want to start in reverse order because I think the key of this is the F in ETF stands for fund. That is, you're talking about, in essence, it's not exactly this, but in essence, it's a mutual fund concept, but in a different wrapper that's accessible to investors. So you have an investment vehicle that offers commingled investment opportunities for clients. It has an investment strategy. It has a prospectus, just like a mutual fund does, that explains its objectives and costs and investment approach and so forth. And there are different ETFs for all sorts of different investment strategies, just like there are all sorts of different mutual funds, each with its own kind of investment strategies. But then there's other elements of it too, which is it's this mutual fund concept, but now it trades on an exchange. And so it kind of trades like a security, like an individual stock that you'd go out and buy on a brokerage platform. But it's a underlying portfolio of securities like a mutual fund and gives you that diversified exposure.
Joel, this might be a topic that you're closer to than I am, but when was the first ETF created?
So the first ETF in the U.S. was the was an S&P 500 product put out by State Street in 1993. But there was actually a precursor to that in Canada a couple of years earlier, while the one here in the U.S. was sort of going through the regulatory process. But they've been around for about 25 years now overall. Over the last decade, the ETF structure in the U.S. has garnered quite a lot more cash flow than, say, traditional mutual funds, a couple of trillion dollars of net cash flow, whereas traditional mutual funds have had negative cash flow over the last decade or so in aggregate. But that's in some ways, it's a question of whether that's the investment vehicle or just kind of a preference of how people access different investment strategies like indexing or active management. But they certainly have made significant inroads in many, many places in the last years and get the question all the time about, you know, are those appropriate for me and how?
Do you think it's more a factor of advisors using ETFs? With their clients as opposed to direct retail investors actually selecting ETFs on their own? Or is it a good mix of both at this point of the maturity of the industry?
Well, I think it's a lot like the other discussion we were just having a moment ago on the phones and different uses by different people, but yet using the same technology, if you will, in that institutional investors, professional traders, hedge funds, and so forth may use them because they like the fact that, you know, ETFs can trade very, you know, basically anytime the market is open, you can trade an ETF very easily.
Yeah, and that's because they trade on a brokerage platform, right? So you need an exchange. And that's probably one of the features that we're most familiar with ETFs, is the ability to trade on the open market.
Right, exactly. Advisors have been using them more and more because they can provide nice building blocks for portfolios and portfolio construction. Matter of fact, some of the largest ETFs are those that provide general market exposure, whether it be to the stock market, bond market, international equities, and so forth. And so they've in many ways become the core of some basic portfolio construction approaches. You know, if you have an asset allocation that's 60% stocks and 40% bonds, you can get very low cost, broad-based exposure to match that asset allocation in many ETFs. Now, I would argue you can also get it in traditional mutual funds, but there's definitely been a move in the advisor community to use ETFs in the portfolio construction realm. The retail investors have kind of been the third to start adopting ETFs. And, you know, again, from a portfolio construction investment strategy standpoint, generally low costs in many ways, you've seen a lot of increase, especially in the context of the brokerage platform and the trading that you mentioned. In the brokerage standpoint, it's just sometimes can be a little bit more fungible. You know, it's easier to move ETF or security holdings from one brokerage to another. It's a little bit more portable.
All right, so Joel, we're starting to talk a little bit around maybe some of the similarities or differences with mutual funds. So one is the trading flexibility.
Yeah, I would say this is the big question that we get from clients is, how do I make the choice between ETF and mutual fund and what's appropriate for me?
Or do I hold both and why?
Right, exactly.
So as you start to break that down, right, so as clients ask us this question, first is, well, and it doesn't necessarily have to be first, but one factor is how they trade. They trade differently. So simply put, if you want to purchase an ETF, you need to have a brokerage account.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you can't just call up the mutual fund company and say, I want to have $1,000 taken from my bank account and directly into the mutual fund shares. You know, with an ETF, as you said, Maria, have to have the brokerage account, and the money has to be in the brokerage account to be able to purchase the shares on the open market.
Okay.
So, yeah, oftentimes there'll be these sweep accounts, or, you know, the money is there in a cash-like vehicle, and then you can have the transaction occur.
Right. So you have got the trading flexibility with an ETF, so you can trade, you know, throughout the day on the exchange. Mutual funds, on the other hand, you put in your purchase or your redemption. You don't know the price that you're going to get until after the market closes, right? After the mutual fund is priced, the net asset value is then the share price for the transaction.
Right. That's certainly one of the trade-offs. The way that we'll often talk about it is with the mutual fund, you get what I would call is value certainty. That is, the value of the securities is reflected in the value of the portfolio because it's priced once a day at 4 o'clock. Typically, whenever you put in the trade, you will get the next value price. So you have that kind of value certainty. With the ETF, you get what I would refer to as price certainty. That is, you know at the time of the trade what price you're paying for the basket of securities. It is the way the ETFs are structured, which we don't need to go into gory detail, but there's a mechanism to try to keep the price of the security of the ETF in line with the underlying basket of securities. So, for example, if it's a S&P 500 U.S. equity ETF, its price movements are going to be pretty close to in line with the price movements of the underlying S&P 500 stocks, but not absolutely perfectly in line. And so you might be paying just a little bit more, just a little bit less than the value of the underlying securities. That's why, you know, it's kind of that price certainty. But you have that certainty that when that trade happens, you know what the price is and what you've transacted at, rather than having to wait for you know, whenever that next time is that it's priced.
But with that, then, let's talk a little bit around the trade execution. So with mutual funds, you have an expense ratio.
Yeah, in terms of the cost of managing the portfolio.
Right. You may or may not have commissions, depending upon whether it's load or no load.
Yes.
With ETFs, though, by and large, you're dealing with brokerage transactions, which for many investors may be subject to commissions.
There's certainly some additional things to sort of figure out, if you will, with the ETF trading. There's still an expense ratio on the underlying portfolio. We can talk about the costs of that in a moment. There might be a brokerage commission. There's also something called market impact or bid-ask spreads that come into play with the ETFs a bit more because, you know, you're kind of buying on an exchange and there's a middleman involved. So there's a little bit of a profit from that middleman as to whether it's, you know, so there's a little bit often difference between the buying price and the selling price if you go at a point in time.
Is that transparent to the investor, though?
It can be. You know, it's the bid-ask spread is available on a lot of the brokerage platforms, and you can see what it would be if you bought or you sold. There's other more sophisticated ways of trading ETFs, which probably are good to know if you start trading them a lot. Different types of orders and so forth in the brokerage space. But regardless, there's some amount of market impact that occurs over and above the expense ratio. But the market impact is kind of at the time you trade the security. The expense ratio is an ongoing annual charge. The other thing, though, that I think sometimes is important to understand is ETFs are traded in shares, typically. You buy a certain number of shares of the ETF, and a price per share gives you the name.
As you would with an individual stock, for instance.
Exactly. Right. But mutual funds are typically denominated in terms of the transaction amount being in dollars. I'll buy $5,000 of this mutual fund, whereas you buy 100 shares, for example, of an ETF. That has some pros and cons. I mean, you may end up with a not perfectly invested portfolio because there's some residual amount of the, you know, when you're buying in shares. If you wanted to invest $5,000, you might not be able to invest exactly $5,000 in an ETF, probably be very close to it. But I think the other piece of it is that because of the shares designation, there's really not a minimum investment. And I know that's often a thing for people starting out in investing. You know, and how you think about, you know, what vehicle do I choose? And sometimes that might be done by, you know, how much of a minimum is there?
Yes, I do think in particular young investors with limited means for investing will think about account minimums. And I mean, one could say that ETFs could be a foray into investing since you can buy per shares as opposed to having to do an account minimum amount.
Yeah, one share may only cost you $20 or $50 or something like that. And yet you have this entire basket of broadly diversified securities of stocks or bonds or whatever. Very low cost, you know, cheap way to get into diversified investing.
So let's talk about young investors for a bit, right? So when I think about ETFs and I think about the mechanics of this, one of the things I think about is someone who has a systematic investment plan or reinvestment of dividends, for instance, right? So these are traded on the brokerage platform. They trade like individual securities. If I'm in a situation where I'm doing a systematic investing program, right, maybe direct investments with my paycheck every 2 weeks or so, if I'm purchasing in ETFs, every time I do that, I could potentially, it's a new trade, I could potentially be subjected to new commissions and things like that, which take a bite out of my investing.
Yeah, if you're paying $8 per trade, you know, it doesn't matter whether the trade is $100 or $10,000, if you will. That could certainly eat into the sort of total investment value if you're doing a lot of smaller systematic trades on which you're subject to a commission.
So I think it's one of those where to do your homework in terms of understanding how they trade, the features that they offer, and then what the trade-off is in cost.
Well, let's talk about the features a little bit. I mean, how do we think about, you know, are there big differences between the fund and the ETF? You mentioned there might be fee differences, minimums. I'm just thinking, you know, the underlying investments themselves. I mean, often there may not be a lot of differences relative to other vehicles that you might be in.
Well, you're using the term vehicles. It's like cars.
Yeah.
Let's go back to our car analogy.
Yeah, the engine may be the same, right? So the ETF engine or the mutual fund engine at the end of it is a diversified portfolio of securities.
Mm-hmm. That's what features do you want in that car that will literally get you to where you want to go. Well, they'll both get you to where you want to go. It's just what the ride is like or what, how.
We're going to get this transportation analogy to work.
Just buy your new car, Joel.
Just honk the horn.
No, just lease your new car. That's it.
That's right. No, but I think that's right. And that's why, you know, I said jokingly at the beginning, you know, the F in ETF stands for fund. At the end of the day, the underlying investment pool is very similar to an investment pool you would get from a mutual fund. There may be differences in the features, the costs, the accessibility, the portability, you know, the reinvestment of dividends, as you mentioned, which in a mutual fund can often be done automatically, and in an ETF it may take a few days, extra days before they get invested. But, you know, kind of on the margins, there are some differences in how you want to access them, but the underlying engine is very, very similar.
Yeah, the one thing I wanted to talk to you about is around the tax efficiency, right? It wouldn't be a Planner and the Geek podcast without a discussion around tax efficiency.
We love taxes, don't we?
There's a strong notion, I think, out there that ETFs, by and large, are more tax efficient. And that may or may not be the case, right? When you're looking at index-based mutual funds versus ETFs, may not be that big of a difference.
Yeah, that's the key, what you said right there. Is it's always interesting to debate the tax efficiency of ETFs, which it is definitely thrown out there as a potential benefit of ETFs versus traditional mutual funds. And there is a certain feature of ETFs which is more, if you will, institutionalized, which is that they, when trading occurs in the portfolio, now, when you, Maria, or I are trading an ETF among us, let's say I sell an ETF share and you want to buy one, those are crossed on the exchange. There's no portfolio management activity that occurs. So you've bought, I've sold, but there's no security transactions in the portfolio. When securities transactions occur in the portfolio, either because a manager has to rebalance the portfolio, new security enters, or there's an imbalance of buys and sells at the end of the day, and so these institutional investors interact with the portfolio. Typically, the transactions are done what's called in kind, or that securities are transferred rather than cash. And in that instance, the fund, the ETF, does not have to realize a capital gain for the purposes of distributing it to shareholders, whereas typically any capital gains that are realized from the sales of securities are distributed to all shareholders. And that's why we talk about good tax efficiency or bad tax efficiency at times, is how much additional tax do I have to pay even though I haven't maybe sold my mutual fund or ETF. However, as you mentioned, the index ETF mutual fund debate, the key word there is index. A lot of times, indexing strategies, lower cost, lower turnover, more buy and hold, you know, just trying to replicate a market or sector of a market, tend to not have as much turnover, and all else equal, and it's very hard to have all else equal, but all else equal, tend to be a little bit more tax efficient than, say, more actively managed strategies where you are buying and selling securities in order to try to outperform. So from that standpoint, a lot of the benefit can come from just being an index approach. And so not as much realization of capital gains. But there are some ways in which the ETF structure, although not limited to the ETF, has institutionalized a little bit more tax efficiency with transacting in securities rather than cash.
Okay.
But it is an important distinction, I mean, you know, when we talk about tax efficiency, because then, well, should I think about these for my retirement account, for
That's
example?
That's where I was headed, yes.
Yeah, and what mm-hmm. I mean, what do you think from that standpoint?
Well, no, I mean, if it's in a retirement account, the point is moot, really, right? Because all the earnings, everything is deferred or potentially tax-free if you're in a Roth.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you're just not taxed year to year, right? So, yeah, you think about what is often purported as some big of one of the benefits of ETFs, which is, you know, the tax efficiency piece. And you're right; it just doesn't, in a retirement account that's tax sheltered, where, let's face it, I mean, the majority of people's assets are these days in tax-sheltered advice. I mean, outside, especially outside of the real high net worth piece of it, it's in 401ks and IRAs.
Right.
And, you know, now it may still be the case that an ETF might make sense because of cost. For example, take Vanguard's products. I mean, pretty much for all of our index funds, we have an ETF version and a traditional mutual fund version that all share the same portfolio. So they're exactly the same, except either in terms of their trading piece with the ETF or in terms of the costs of different what we call share classes. Well, if you have less than $10,000 to invest in a Vanguard index fund, the ETF is actually going to be cheaper than the sort of traditional shares. On the other hand, if you have access to the really large institutional share classes, oftentimes they're lower cost than the ETF would be. So, you know, depending on what you have access to, you know, a large employer with a 401k plan may offer a institutional share class that's lower cost than what an ETF would be. And so maybe that is the right option in that case. So it's all this, it often will come down again back to those set of features that may be different, you know, depending on the circumstance.
Yeah, I would agree. And as I'm listening to you, Joel, I'm thinking through, okay, well, when we think about our clients and the questions that we get from them in terms of how do I choose, I often think first and foremost is cost, right? When we talk about Vanguard's investing principles, for instance, control the things you can control, right? Focus on those things. Cost is one of them. So focus on the cost differentials and make sure you understand what you're paying and how. And then also, I think the other piece might be, if I've already made the decision where I want to go into an index product, do I need the trading flexibility that an ETF affords? Right, assuming I can meet the account minimums and I have the means to do that,
right,
it really comes down then to, do I'm looking for this trading flexibility potentially, is the two big things. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I generally do agree with that. And the only thing I would add is that where you are purchasing the vehicle may matter or may be different. So for example, let's say, heaven forbid, because I'm not suggesting this, but that you're buying a Vanguard product but at a different brokerage platform. It may be that there are different fees on ETFs or funds, and that could turn this decision as well. So it's the fees of the underlying portfolio that matter. And as we've talked about the other types of commissions that show up, because sometimes you can buy a Vanguard mutual fund from a non-Vanguard provider, but there may be a transaction fee associated with that, just like there might be a transaction fee or commission with the ETF. Sometimes those are different. I should also point out that starting this month, in August, you'll be able to purchase not only Vanguard ETFs, but also ETFs from more than 100 other companies commission-free when you invest online at Vanguard.com.
Okay, so it does come down to cost, but what you're saying, though, is to be careful in terms of any additional or incremental costs because of how you trade.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. And they can be different on the you know, on the different structures, mm-hmm. whether it be a mutual fund mm-hmm. or an ETF. But ultimately, the you know, the whether it's a ETF or an index traditional mutual fund, again, I often reiterate this, probably beating dead horses too much, about the underlying portfolios, and especially in Vanguard's case where they share the same portfolio. You know, if it's an S&P 500 ETF or an S&P 500 traditional fund, they're sharing the same actual portfolio in terms of investment results. That's not the differentiator, if you will. You're still getting broadly diversified, low-cost investment exposure.
Well, to go back into the Joel Dixon archives, didn't you call them kissing cousins at one point? The mutual.
Yeah, and I was told never to use that analogy again.
I used it.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just as horrified now as I was back then when I heard it.
Yeah, exactly, because they are very similar in terms of the investment exposures that they give. It's just a little bit different of how you access them.
Okay. Now you can't use that. I can't use it anymore, nor can you.
Wow, I thought you were going to pull out a different one, but that, yeah, I'd actually burnished that one from my memory. So, well, you know, Maria, we had talked a little bit earlier about, you know, how these get used by different types of investors. And, you know, we obviously have a very kind of Vanguard take on, you know, what we've discussed and what we know. We did want to bring in an expert to talk a little bit more about the ETF industry, generally, kind of the growth and the development, and he has a little bit of a different view on it. And his name is Eric Balchunas. Eric is a senior ETF analyst at Bloomberg. Actually, I've known him for years when I used to work on ETF issues more directly.
And he's still willing to come in and talk to us?
He is. I think part of it is, yeah, he's a South Philly guy, and so he likes to help out other Philly, sort of areas when he can. Maybe we'll chalk cheesesteaks or something with him. But Eric is going to join us, as I mentioned, senior ETF analyst at Bloomberg, long-time experience working with ETFs over a decade in terms of data and designing new functions for a lot of the work that Bloomberg does in terms of its tools that are often used more by professional investors. But he's been, you know, really on the front lines of a lot of what's been happening in the ETF industry. He also writes a bunch of articles, research notes, features, blog posts, even has a weekly TV show on Bloomberg on ETFs. So he can provide a little bit more of this perspective of how retail investors have been using ETFs, how the ETF industry has grown, and how it may continue to develop. And so really excited to have him join us and provide some of his experience and wisdom. I'm joined today by Eric Balchunas, who's senior ETF analyst with Bloomberg Intelligence. And Eric, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you, Eric. I mean, one, you're a Philly guy, right? So we could sit here and actually talk, you know, the Eagles for the next 15 or 20 minutes.
You guys are like local to me. There's not much, there's not a lot going on ETF-wise in Philly besides, well, Revenue Shares was there. There's a couple analysts, and then obviously Vanguard, which is a little outside of the city.
You've been involved in the ETF industry and marketplace for really years in many ways as ETFs really started to grow and explode on the scene. Both in terms of writing about them now, much more from an analyst standpoint. In fact, for our listeners, Eric does host a podcast that is largely devoted to ETFs and the ETF industry called Trillions. And so folks can certainly find that on iTunes if they're interested from that standpoint, as well as now even a weekly TV show called ETF IQ on Bloomberg TV. It's great, Eric, to be able to get your perspective here. I'd really love to just get a sense of, you know, what intrigues you about ETFs? You know, how did you get so interested and involved in sort of the ETF industry, for your career?
Yeah, I mean, my first job was writing for Fund Action, which is an institutional investor newsletter. And I honestly took that job because I was a journalist and I like the economy. So it was a pretty good job, but I just got assigned to that one, and it was a good fit. It was a nice I like funds in general because they cover everything. And so for somebody who's intellectually curious, it sort of – and, you know, gets bored quickly. ETFs or funds in general take you everywhere, and so you sort of have to be not just a mile deep and an inch wide, but a mile deep and a mile wide. And so there's endless sort of intellectual stimulation. And ETFs in particular, which I was sort of assigned in 2008, around there, when I was in data for Bloomberg. I was in data for 15 years at Bloomberg, making sure all the data was right on the terminal. And when I got ETFs, as somebody who had tracked mutual funds, I fairly quickly saw this as a huge deal. Because if you know the mutual fund and then you start looking around the ETF, you realize that it's got, you know, many, many advantages. So A, the advantages of the ETF, I saw it as a breakthrough technology and was proven correct. And then B, the idea that ETFs democratize everything. And I find that really appealing. And they basically break through all the share classes that mutual funds had. It's basically giving you the Sam's Wholesale Club pricing. And everybody is using the same product. And I like that democratization angle and the sort of the way they track all different areas. And like for Vanguard, you guys stick more to the sort of core. But there's even some fascination of stuff you guys don't track, like the VIX market, the VIX futures, or robotics. I mean, there's a lot of stuff you sort of have to learn about when you cover ETFs. And I love that endless learning process.
And just for the listeners, VIX would be a volatility approaches and so forth. It's kind of the some might call more esoteric, some more complicated, but definitely, as you said, there is a whole landscape of ETF products and approaches. In fact, I'd like to highlight a little bit more that democratization angle that you just brought up. Can you talk a little bit more about, in the context of the trends that you have seen in this industry, in terms of cost, in terms of investment strategy, in terms of accessibility of investment approaches to many different types of clients, is that what you mean by that democratization piece?
It's twofold. One is that ETFs go out and wrap up everything that you can think of. So not just asset classes or sectors or countries, but also strategies or trades, right? Currency hedged ETFs, which go long a local set of stocks, but neutralize the currency effects. That's sort of a popular trade that institutions have been doing for ages, but now it's packaged into an ETF. Or there's ETFs that will invest in stocks and then write call options on those stocks to give you income. That's a trade people have been doing forever. They package that up. And so there's that democratization, that things that only institutions used to be able to do, now retail can do. However, when you do that, you definitely wrap up some stuff that retail probably shouldn't touch. But I think it's worth it in the net that they do go out and do that. That's the one way they've democratized investing. The second way, again, is that they just eliminated the share class system that I believe with mutual funds is like a regressive tax. The less money that you have, the more they charge you, right? The A class and then the B and the C, and then the institutional class, if you can pony up a lot of money, you get charged a lot less. And so ETFs sort of come out at the institutional class level, and there is no share classes. It's basically like everybody gets the same price. And a great example I use, which it does include this Vanguard example in my presentation, is that, you know, it's fascinating that VWO can count as clients my mom and the world's largest hedge fund. And there is no other – there's never been any other scenario ever where those two people would be in the same product paying the same fee. So that's the second way they've democratized investing. And both those are very exciting.
Yeah, Eric, I would just highlight we regularly talk here about Joel's mom and what she does from a standpoint. So the fact that we got Eric's mom in this too is terrific. I did just want to clarify two quick things. One, VWO is the ticker symbol for the Vanguard Emerging Markets ETF, for those that are listening. And then the second thing is that when we talk about share classes and this evolution of share classes, in many ways, historically, the mutual fund share classes were built around different commission payment structures in many ways. Now, Vanguard also has share classes, continues to this day, though those tend to be structured more around pricing at different levels of minimum investment. But as you said, the ETF share class, which is one share class of many in Vanguard's funds, is available to anyone regardless of their investment amount and so forth.
Yeah, and the lack of distribution fees or commissions is another thing that excites me about the ETF industry, because I always say that ETFs got their, I think they're up to $3.5 trillion in assets the hard way. They don't pay anybody. They're not in any 401k plans where a lot of that money is sort of like fish jumping in the boat. They had to win their money by convincing picky, after-tax, early adopter, do-it-yourself types. So if you can get $3.5 trillion that way, I just think the sky's the limit because that's the hardest way to get those assets.
When you think about that $3.5 trillion, as you said, really growing from nothing to $3.5 trillion over the course of the last roughly 20 to 25 years, what do you attribute to in terms of the success and the sort of features of the ETF that have done that?
Well, you know, I've frequently compared the ETF to the MP3 in that it's not the artist or the music that you're interested in. It's the format to get there, and I just think that, like, the MP3 completely revolutionized the way music is listened to. I think the ETF's done that in that it has – look, or Uber. These are things that have many, many advantages or attributes. Now, you may not care that it has intraday liquidity, but an institution sure does. Or, you may not care that it's low cost. You just want the intraday liquidity, or vice versa. Other people like the fact that they don't really distribute capital gains. They almost have a perfect record. So this tax efficiency, the fact that you can see what's in them every day, they're transparent. So they've got this laundry list of attributes. That's one thing. If you have a lot of things going for you, you're eventually going to attract fans, right? Just like the MP3 is just an easier, cheaper, more efficient, flexible format in which to consume music. That's sort of what the ETF was. The other thing is, I think that, you know, people are wary of new things that come out of Wall Street, especially if it's got an acronym. And just, I think that what in 2008 to me was the real turning point where, you know, up until that point, I think they even had less than a trillion in assets. But 2008, when really the market saw some wild trading days and some steep drawdowns, and people saw that ETFs could, you know, take a beating and still, you know, do their job, and the structure could hold up under that kind of a stress, I think that really is what convinced even skeptics that this thing is worth it, because they might have liked the fact that it was low cost or straight trading. Maybe they were worried that, you know, it might be a structure that hasn't really been tested. I think that was huge. And then since then, the market has had this nice bull market run, which has helped. Although I don't think that's the only reason. A lot of active managers will tell you that the ETF and passive rise is only because the market's been so – it's been easy to make money. I disagree completely. I think that on the flip, if there's a bear market, that's when you're really going to see ETFs and passive take even more market share, or if the market stops returning so much, because people will then be more focused on cost than in this type of market. So I think all of that combined is why you saw that. And then, of course, I call it the media chain. You know, back in the day, you only heard bloggers or conferences would mention ETFs. It was sort of on the street level only. Then you had, luckily, because the internet is around, you have media reading the bloggers, and then you have barons reporting on it, and it sort of filtrates down. And 2 years ago, I saw USA Today do a huge story on low cost and ETFs, and it was on the front page in that chart. And when it gets into USA Today, it sort of reached the end of the media line. And so that kind of coverage all the way from the bloggers to the mainstream over the last 10 years, I also think has helped. Because once it's in USA Today, I think it's been vetted, and certainly retail people would have more trust with some of those mainstream publications and more awareness.
Eric, we just now need to get it on Saturday Night Live and in People Magazine and in Cosmo, right?
Well, the one thing about ETFs is that if I go to Thanksgiving dinner, I still – half of my relatives – and, you know, I do this for a living – couldn't tell you what it stands for. So I think – and that's why we spoke with a different issuer on our podcast who said that we asked them what the white space in ETFs was. And instead of picking a product, like asset class that they could, like, you know, serve, they went in the other way and said the retail investor is the white space. So I do think that there's so much room for growth for people like that. And again, so I even though it's known and anybody listening to this is probably more on the do-it-yourself front, there's still, I think, a lot of room for people to, to become aware of it.
Kind of wanted to get there a little bit in terms of this. Who is buying the, as you said, it's a democratization that's occurred. So it's the institutional investor, it's your mom, it's financial advisors throughout the landscape. Who historically has been buying ETFs? And then you mentioned the sort of do-it-yourself retail investor. Are you seeing more and more sort of, you know, take up by that segment?
Yeah. So early on, it was only institutions that used them. Again, because they trade, they were basically able to use them like a futures contract, except better than the futures contract, they actually held the stocks or bonds, so they were physically backed. So it was like the best of both worlds, and institutions really used them at first. I mean, Vanguard launching certainly sealed the deal for retail. And then advisors, to me, are the perfect client. In fact, I think last I checked, I usually quote numbers around this. Like, I think about half to two-thirds of the money is probably vis-a-vis advisors. And the reason they like ETF so much is because – they've moved from commission-based to fee-based. So when you're getting a percentage of your client's assets, all of a sudden you're now shoulder-to-shoulder with that client. And so your focus is going to be on fee, and advisors are well aware that cost is so huge, and they're well aware of the lack of ability to outperform over long stretches by active. So unless they were going to get paid by the fund, now they're going to get a percentage of the portfolio. That shift from the commission model to the fee-based model was major. And so when you're now sort of fiduciary and getting paid that way, that to me opened the floodgates. And so advisors are the biggest client, and then I think you probably have maybe, and you guys probably have your own numbers, but 15%, 20% institutions, depending on how you define institution. And then a sliver would be sort of do-it-yourself retail. That sliver, I think, is what a lot of people think will be a bigger growth area.
Yeah, I would also, you know, like to touch on two other sort of items of the ETF space. With new technology, if you will, the next generation of the mutual fund in some ways, as some have called it, there come then these whole hosts of yes, but. And, you know, the criticisms that occur around ETFs, they're blamed, I think, for all sorts of things like hurricanes and earthquakes. But, you know, in particular, there is this question about, hey, if they are so easy to trade, you can trade them very, you know, on pretty much any platform. They're portable, intraday, so forth. Does that actually induce kind of bad behavior on the part of clients and investors?
Sure. So I have this PowerPoint that I'm currently doing. It's one of my two. I'm like a musician with set lists. And one of my PowerPoint presentations is called ETFs, Godsend or WMDs. And there's been a lot of attacks, especially last year. A lot of those attacks come from active managers who are nervous and scared about their own livelihood, so they lash out at ETFs and say all kinds of things. Most of them can be easily refuted with some contextual data. But what you're bringing up to me is what I call legit concern. So even though I shoot down some of these histrionics that you hear from active, I do pivot because I'm not a cheerleader here. I'm trying to call it like I see it. And I do think that the number one legit concern is what you just said, which is they're so good and so easy that you could definitely lose yourself. And if you start trading too much, bad behavior would completely destroy all of the cost savings and tax benefits that the ETF offers. So that's why I compare the ETF to the movie Gremlins, right? Remember?
Oh, an 80s reference. Oh, we love our 80s references.
Me too. I'm big on them. I basically, up until year 2000, I'm not 80s and 90s, I'm reference king. But anyway, in Gremlins, just so people haven't seen it, the Mogwai is this cute little furry animal. And it comes with three rules, you know, no sunlight, don't feed it after midnight, etc. And of course the boy does, and so the Mogwai turns into this evil sort of gremlin with sharp teeth, and they procreate and sort of tear up the town. To me, that's an ETF in a nutshell. It is a wonderful vehicle, but you kind of have to follow a couple rules for yourself so you don't destroy all those benefits. And I think, you know, one of those is don't overtrade. Don't lose your mind trading. Just because you can trade the Russia small cap ETF at noon and sell it at 2 doesn't mean you should.
I'm thinking, what other ways can I think about ETFs in the 80s? And I'm thinking, oh, they're, you know, in many ways they're like the mullet, you know, professional in the front and a party in the back. Let me just kind of ask one last sort of piece of this, which is, you know, we've talked 3.5 trillion or so in ETF assets. There are thousands of different ETFs. How do you wade through and for maybe an individual investor, somebody who's not as familiar with the whole ETF landscape and ecosystem, how to find what's right for that person? And in particular, I'm going to lead you a little bit here. I'd love for you to sort of talk about your spotlight system as a way to help cut through some of the complexity here.
Sure. So in terms of ETF due diligence, in my book, I outline the same way that professional ETF strategists do it. You look for the exposure. You get to start with what you want. I mean, what's your goal here? You want emerging markets? Okay, fine. Let's go look at the different ETFs. What's the exposure? What do they track? Look at the holdings. Look at how the index is weighted, and you know what exactly is it holding. Then you got to look at the cost, and that's in terms of expense ratio, and also the spread. You know, how much is a trade? How much is the bid-ask spread in like percentage terms is useful. Then you want to look at the liquidity, how much does it trade every day, and also how liquid is the basket. You know, I have this sort of rule of thumb that think about the exoticness of what you're trying to get. If you're going and you want Vietnam stocks, you know, you're going to probably expect maybe a wider spread or some maybe the price moving away from the NAV a little more. You have to accept a little bit. The ETF isn't magic, okay? It's not going to turn everything into trading like SPY. But you should demand a lot if it's a plain vanilla area like the S&P 500. That said, liquidity is important, and then also risk. I keep risk simple. I just look at standard deviation. It's a foolproof way. I mean, I know it's simple, but the standard deviation to me is sort of like the sign on a ski slope. It's how steep is the ride going to be? And you want to look at the standard deviation of, say, SPY or the S&P 500, and then look at your ETF versus that, because you kind of get an idea of how much the S&P 500 moves. Is this ETF lower or higher than that? And then, therefore, you can get a gauge on how much risk you're taking on. And then, finally, the structure. There's some weird structures out there, like GLD is a grantor trust that gets taxed differently.
That's a physical gold ETF, right?
Yeah, like all Vanguards are 40 Act, plain vanilla, straight up funds.
Yep.
But there are some different structures out there, and there are some benefits to using some of the other ones. But long story short, that's probably the fifth one. My traffic light system is not designed to do due diligence for you exactly. It's more designed to solve this problem of what I talked about earlier, which is that when ETFs have gone out and tracked everything, you know, they've wrapped up everything, some of the stuff they're bringing back to you is pretty wild. And I find that leverage ETFs, ETFs to track VIX futures, as we spoke about earlier, or oil futures, you don't want to see an investor get hurt. And I think that when you have all these ETFs seemingly trading like shares of Microsoft, you can tend to think that they're all sort of as safe as sort of, you know, VWO or a regular ETF. This traffic light system simply looks at 10 areas where there we call them nasty surprises. And if there's anything that gets triggered, like alternative tax treatment or leverage, or is it, you know, a credit risk because of an ETN? There's just a whole laundry list of ways it could get dinged. And if it basically comes across and has 0 to 1, it's a green light. 1 to 2, it's a yellow light. And 3 and beyond, it's red. This is very akin to the movie rating system, right? If a movie has just a lot of violence, like a Quentin Tarantino movie, it's rated R just on the amount of violence. That would be like the amount of leverage, right? Or there's other movies that might have a little bit of a couple things that the movie rating agency doesn't like to see, and you might get an R on that movie. Long story short, this is to protect the innocent while allowing innovation and products for professionals, because the ETF structure is so good that there is products out there tracking complicated things that people would just rather have in an ETF format. So I don't think I think you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. But having a traffic light system makes it easy. So you could just focus on green and yellow light stuff. And I do think that lumping ETFs into, say, safe or dangerous, it's more nuanced than that. Like, what would you, what would a high yield ETF be? I mean, we call that a yellow light. It's sort of in the middle. Yes, it's wrapping up junk bonds, but it's long only and it holds them like any other ETF. So again, this is a way to sort of make it a little more nuanced and protect investors. Because let's face it, people are just probably never going to read the prospectus, even though they should. And this sort of helps do their job easier and keep them away from sort of products that could lose them a lot of money quickly.
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. Now, the traffic light system that you've developed is available really through just the Bloomberg terminal. Is that correct? Or are there other ways that people might be able to access that?
Besides the show and the podcast, is premium content on the terminal, including the traffic light. However, the traffic light has such a retail purpose, and my superiors understand that I'm happy to email the PDF white paper on it as well as my spreadsheet with the ETFs and the score they get. If somebody sends me an email to ebalchunas@bloomberg.net, I'm happy to send you the system just as a, you know, friendly gesture.
Well, that's terrific, Eric. Thank you very much for joining us. Once again, I'd just like to say, you know, Eric, as a real expert and, you know, been with the ETF industry, if you will, in many ways since its spectacular growth over the course of the last decade. As we already mentioned, you know, has his own ETF podcast called Trillions that you can find on the iTunes online store, for example, where you can also find the Planner and the Geek here from Vanguard. So, Eric, thanks again for joining us. Really appreciate your insight and expertise.
Thanks, Joel. Great being with you.
I thought Eric's ETF spotlight, this notion of red, yellow, green in terms of complexity, was brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, a way to just summarize in a very easy way. Because
it's very intuitive.
I think sometimes ETFs get used as a, you know, all-encompassing term, that they're all the same, that they're all part of the same asset class. But just like with any investment strategy, there are more complex ones, more volatile ones, you know, some take more risks, some take less. And, you know, this concept of, you know, being able to highlight kind of the ones that provide the most basic exposure versus those that are more involved,
right.
If you will, is an important way to think about it.
And I think it's good, too, when you think about it in the context of portfolio construction. So think about top-down approach. Figure out what your asset allocation is, your sub-asset allocation within that, for instance, how much U.S. versus non-U.S. you might want. And then how do you actually implement that in terms of vehicles, whether they're mutual funds or ETFs. And when you're in ETF space, something like this can help as another qualifier in terms of how are you investing to achieve that asset class or sub-asset class.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, that portfolio construction piece, how do you fill that up? Not doing a collection of funds, but focusing on that asset allocation component, and then what are the available opportunities for me at the, you know, lowest cost in order to achieve the exposure that I want, that I can use in that portfolio. And it gives that context to it, and people may find it's a mix of things. ETF fund, you know, that can gain that exposure that they're seeking.
Doesn't have to be all or nothing, as we talk about it a lot during our podcast.
Diversification, right? In many different forms.
So we covered a lot. The one thing I will suggest is for our listeners who want to learn more, as usual, I'll make our plug for Vanguard.com. We have a page on ETFs. For listeners that want to learn more, they can go there and learn more about ETFs, but also help navigate whether or not they're right for their particular situation.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. And you know, as we also say, also encourage our listeners to, you know, write reviews on the podcast themselves. We actually read them. I know you and I end up texting if there's a new review or something. It's like, hey, did you see the new review?
We do read the reviews. We like the ratings. The reviews are quite insightful, and how we can, also how we pick topics.
Yeah. I think there should be some sort of like secret word too that, you know, the people that have listened to this podcast, you know, can put into the review so that we know that they listened to this particular podcast.
Oh, you want to add another element of challenge to our podcast?
Yeah, exactly. I think, I think our readers, or if our listeners use the term Sangria Maria, we'll know that they listened to this podcast. You know, figure out how to put that into a review.
Good
and
one,
Joel. It would be great. No, but seriously, I mean, we do read the reviews. We like seeing them, and any topic ideas for of interest that that people might have for future podcasts are greatly appreciated.
All right, Joel. Well, thank you. I want to thank Eric as well for joining us today, and to our listeners, thanks. We enjoyed this episode. We hope you enjoyed as much as we did. We hope you enjoyed this episode of The Planner and the Geek. Just a reminder that you can find more episodes of The Planner and the Geek on iTunes and on Vanguard.com.
Or simply subscribe to our series and you won't miss an episode. And please don't forget to rate us on iTunes. Your ratings will make it easier for others to find us when they're looking for investing podcasts. Please join us next time for another episode of The Planner and the Geek.
For more information about Vanguard Fund or Vanguard ETFs, visit Vanguard.com or call 877-662-7447 to obtain a prospectus or, if available, a summary prospectus. Investment objectives, risks, charges, expenses, and other important information are contained in the prospectus. Read and consider it carefully before investing. Vanguard ETF shares are not redeemable with the issuing fund other than in very large aggregations worth millions of dollars. Instead, investors must buy and sell Vanguard ETF shares in the secondary market and hold those shares in a brokerage account. In doing so, the investor may incur brokerage commissions and may pay more than net asset value when buying and receive less than net asset value when selling. Please remember that all investments involve some risk. Be aware that fluctuations in the financial markets and other factors may cause declines in the value of your account. There is no guarantee that any particular asset allocation or mix of funds will meet your investment objectives or provide you with a given level of income. All investing is subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Diversification does not ensure a profit or protect against a loss. We recommend that you consult a tax or financial advisor about your individual situation. Except where noted, opinions presented are those of the author or speaker and do not necessarily reflect the views of Vanguard or its management. None of the information outlined here should be construed as financial advice from Vanguard. The information provided here is for educational purposes only and is not intended to be construed as legal or tax advice. We recommend that you consult a tax or financial advisor about your individual situation. Copyright 2018, The Vanguard Group, Incorporated. All rights reserved. Vanguard Marketing Corporation, distributor of the Vanguard Funds.